the final case of the day, appeal number 04-1276, Van Patten versus Depesh, and Ms. Coberly.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Linda Coberly of Winston & Strawn, and I'm here representing the appellant, Joseph Van Patten. Mr. Van Patten is seeking relief from his conviction because his plea of no contest was obtained in violation of his Sixth Amendment right to counsel. As Mr. Van Patten entered his plea and gave up his constitutional rights, he stood alone in the courtroom.
Now, on the day of the plea, was the phone conversation before the hearing the first time he learned that his counsel was not going to be physically present?
Yes. He learned at the end of that phone conversation when he asked. His lawyer was not physically present. He was present by speakerphone. And in that means the defendant could not turn to his counsel to whisper a question, and his counsel was not in a position to observe his demeanor. He was not in a position to see whether there was some nonverbal cue that would indicate that the defendant was concerned about the plea, had a question, or didn't understand some part of the plea colloquy. The magistrate and district court both correctly found that Mr. Van Patten was denied the presence of counsel under United States versus Kronick, but that's where the district court made its critical error. It concluded that the Kronick violation was harmless.
Didn't he agree to proceed in that manner?
He was never asked the question, Your Honor. He did not consent, and the court did not ask him whether he would prefer to reschedule the hearing for another time in which his defense counsel could be personally present.
Now, one of the things you rely heavily on is Silverson versus O'Leary, or Siverson. But Siverson was an 85 case that predated ADEPA. How does this case involve a state court decision that is contrary to or involved an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law?
Your Honor, we're not trying to establish a new constitutional right here. We don't argue that Siverson establishes a right. We argue that the Supreme Court's cases establish a right to the presence of your lawyer at your plea hearing. That's the case in Hamilton, in White versus Maryland, in Williams versus Kaiser, and it's discussed in Kronick itself. The Supreme Court handed down Kronick and Strickland on the same day, and those two cases set out the analysis that applies to Sixth Amendment claims for right to counsel. The question is which of those two cases applies here. And although the Supreme Court has not...
Kronick applies, there's no harmless error analysis.
Correct.
And the magistrate, or the district judge, identified Kronick as being the controlling law.
Correct.
But applied harmless error analysis.
Correct.
To that.
There are some cases, and Siverson was one of them, actually, in which a Kronick error can be found to be harmless. But that's in a case where the error doesn't pervade the entire proceeding. And both this court and the Supreme Court have recognized that a Kronick violation at a plea hearing necessarily pervades the entire proceeding, because that's the proceeding at which the defendant is giving up his constitutional rights. So that's why the state agrees here that if the district court properly found a Kronick violation, it should have granted the writ outright. It should not have gone on to consider harmless error. So the issue, obviously, is whether the district court correctly found that counsel's failure to appear in person was a violation of the Sixth Amendment under Kronick. And the answer to that question is yes, counsel was not in the courtroom, and his appearance by speakerphone was by no means an adequate substitute. It's just not possible to assess over a speakerphone whether a defendant is entering a plea knowingly and voluntarily and intelligently, and the state admits
that. You say
that
he didn't know what he was doing? Is that your contention?
My contention is that he was, as he testified in his post-conviction hearing, he was confused about his constitutional rights. He felt he was being coerced into the plea because he felt he had no realistic options. And that feeling was based on a faulty understanding of his rights. He believed that if he said no at the hearing, the judge would be mad and would submit the case to the jury without the lesser included offenses. And he also believed that if he if he challenged the plea and rejected it, he would have to fire his counsel and would
Let
have to proceed.
Let me just read something from the interrogation. This is the State of Wisconsin versus Joseph I. Patton. Mr. Van Patten is present. Mr. Van Patten, we are going to put your attorney on the speakerphone. So I want you standing up a little closer to make sure you can hear it. I think you'll be able to hear him. Whereupon the district attorney, Mr. Bruno, said, Mr. Bruno, this is Gary Bruno calling from Judge Smith's courtroom. Can we speak with Mr. Connell? That's your defendant. This is Gary Bruno. I have to turn it up a little, all right? Then he says, Mr. Van Patten at this time is willing to enter a plea of no contest to a charge of first-degree reckless homicide with the penalty enhancer for a dangerous weapon. And we are requesting a pre-sentence investigation. Mr. Connell, that's our agreement. That's your man, isn't it?
Mr. Connell is the lawyer, Your Honor.
The lawyer. Mr. Bruno, the defendant, yes. The court, okay, I want to inquire now, have you thoroughly discussed this with Mr. Van Patten? Yes, Your Honor. And are you going to move to agree to the amended complaint? I believe yes. This is your man, isn't it?
He's answering questions. Mr. Connell was the counsel.
Yeah,
Mr. Van
Patten
was.
Your man is answering all these questions. Did you understand all of these questions, Mr. Van Patten? Yes, I did. Then they go on to recite what the amended complaint is. Do you agree to that? The court asked him. Yes, Your Honor. The defendant, is this your plea at this time? No contest? The defendant, yes, Your Honor. Didn't they go through all that?
They did go through all that, Your Honor, but at that very time, my client... They did go through all those questions, Your Honor, as you always do in a plea colloquy. But at that very time, my client did not have his counsel at his side. He could not turn...
No, he was talking to the court...
Yes.
...over a telephone and to his defendant. And the court was asking the defendant the questions.
Correct.
And the counsel was on the speakerphone in another courtroom.
I don't know where he was, actually.
He may have been in this record.
I'm sorry?
It's right in this record.
That he was calling from another courtroom.
From another courtroom.
Your Honor, my point is, and this is the state courts also relied very heavily on the content of the plea colloquy in deciding that there was no prejudice under Strickland, which I submit is the wrong analysis. But regardless, the fact that the plea colloquy on its face appears to be satisfactory is not good enough. It's not good enough because it's not okay to not have your lawyer in the courtroom.
Let me ask you this, and I understand clearly the guilty plea is a critical phase of the proceeding, which is why Kronik applies. Mm-hmm. The question is, I guess, the Supreme Court has never held that it's ineffective assistance of counsel to have counsel's appearance by telephone.
Correct.
And that, to me, is where the rub is in this case. Could you address that? Because that's what I think, you know, when you're talking about unreasonable application of law, you know, maybe that's where, you know, the rubber hits the road. We give you Kronik. Let's say the court was wrong, that it's you have a Kronik violation, fine, it's harmful, you don't have to do this harmless error analysis. Why don't you speak to that question?
To the question of whether Kronik applies at all here.
No, not Kronik, but whether we know this, the Supreme Court hasn't ruled that having counsel's appearance by phone is ineffective assistance of counsel. Supreme Court hasn't gone that far yet.
That's correct. But we're not seeking to establish some new constitutional right that says that under some amendment you're entitled to not have your counsel appear by phone. What we're doing is relying on Supreme Court case law, on Strickland and Kronik, and there's no dispute that one of those cases applies here. The question is which one. And it doesn't make sense to conclude that just because the Supreme Court has not applied Kronik or Strickland on these specific facts, That's not the analysis. The question under 2254 is there a case in the Supreme Court that's materially indistinguishable, not factually identical? One of those two cases applies here. The question is which one? And it doesn't make sense to conclude that simply because the court has not addressed this precise factual situation, therefore Strickland applies. I don't understand why that would be the presumption. Our position is this is clearly a case where we're talking about the absence of counsel. We're not talking about a specific tactical error. We're not talking about ineptitude of lack of preparation. We're talking about counsel not being in the courtroom. And under those circumstances, it's clear that Kronik applies to this claim, whether or not the Supreme Court has addressed these precise facts before.
Now, your man has had 2 years of college as well, hasn't he?
I believe that's correct.
Right. And he was asked if he understood everything, and he said yes.
Yes, although he also testified at his post-conviction hearing that his lawyer told him before the hearing to say yes to everything. And it was his understanding, based on his conversations...
I'm just going from the transcript that was made in the open court.
I understand, but our position is you can't evaluate the adequacy of his representation merely by looking at the transcript of the hearing at which he was not represented. Thank you.
Mr. Wren.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Christopher Wren. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Wisconsin Department of Justice, and I appear on behalf of Respondent Appellee Jodine Depesch. Before I get into my points, I'd like to express my appreciation to Ms. Coperly for taking this case. It is, in light of its procedural problems, she's done a wonderful job simplifying my job, and I think presenting her client's case on his behalf.
Yeah, we will be thanking her formally and Winston and Strom for loaning her to court for this.
I'd like to make a couple of points. I agree with Judge Williams that this is an issue of the unreasonable application of clearly established federal law, and it's an objectively unreasonable standard, as this court knows. There are two cases that I think explain why Strickland applies to this case and not Kronik. About 10 years in 1980.
Let's talk about that for a minute.
Excuse me?
I just thought this was so unusual at a plea hearing. This is not a status conference to set a date or something like that, but at a plea hearing, obviously a critical stage in the proceeding, that you want the lawyer there personally sitting next to the client, so questions come up, and that everything would have gone forward under that situation rather than adjourn the thing or get the lawyer to come to court or something like that. It just seemed so bizarre to do that. And I mean, this Wisconsin case, I don't recall ever seeing something like this done in Wisconsin.
Well, and we haven't seen a case like this in Wisconsin either, frankly. This is I think, unique in our case law. The other cases that have involved Veneman, which was the case that held that strictly construed Wisconsin statute section 967.08, involved a situation where the defendant was not personally present in court. And all the cases I looked at where this statute has come up have always involved the defendant not being present. This is the only case that I'm aware of where the defendant was present in court and the judge could face him, but the attorney appeared.
Could the attorney appear by telephone during a jury trial?
No, I don't believe the jury, attorney could.
That's enumerated in the statute. He has to be there for trial.
Right, and in the statute
is not covered
for sentencing.
I think in any situation where there might be an evidentiary proceeding and sentencing can involve the presentation of evidence, that the attorney should be present, and I think that the Supreme Court, even if it hasn't held that yet, would hold that.
So you're saying that the attorney does not have to be absolutely present for the taking of a plea in a criminal case?
I think that from a constitutional standpoint, from the way the Supreme Court has decided its cases, that has not been clearly established as a matter of federal law. If we were going up on a direct appeal, or if we were on a petition for a writ of certiorari in this U.S. Supreme Court, there might be a different standard. But right now we're dealing with the AEDPA standard of a clearly unreasonable, of whether this is a clearly unreasonable application an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law. And under these circumstances, I don't believe that it's been clearly established that the telephonic presence violates either Cronic or Strickland. And those are the two cases I agree with Ms. Coverley.
Well, even if we decide that Van Patten must show prejudice in order to establish his Sixth Amendment claim, isn't he entitled to relief because the prejudice analysis was unreasonable under Strickland? I mean, given I understand the Supreme Court hasn't ruled that you cannot have a telephonic presence of a lawyer during a guilty plea. But doesn't the weight of Supreme Court authority, given that this was a critical stage and a guilty plea, I mean, the Supreme mm-hmm. Court doesn't have to spell out every little factual scenario in order for there to be a Strickland violation.
Right. I agree, Judge. And that's why Hill versus Lockhart and Bell v. Cohn help explain why there's no prejudice here and why Cronic doesn't apply. Hill versus Lockhart, which was decided 10 years before this issue came up in Mr. Van Patten's case, held that Strickland applies to guilty pleas and that the prejudice standard to use when applied to guilty pleas is whether it's reasonably probable that absent counsel's errors, defendant would have pleaded guilty anyway. That, I think, gets into the factual findings that occurred in the post-conviction motion hearing in the state court with Judge Schmidt, where these issues were raised. Mr. Van Patten testified. Mr. Van Patten's attorney testified. And the judge said, I don't believe you. You would have pleaded guilty even if he'd been standing right next to you. And I think that satisfies the Hill versus Lockhart standard for prejudice under Strickland. The judge made, in effect, a factual finding that I don't think can be challenged in this court, certainly under not under subsection E, that no prejudice occurred. In Bell versus Cohn, the reason I think that would hold that Cronic doesn't apply is that Bell versus Cohn reads Cronic very literally in terms of what I would call the Category 2 violation, that is the potted plant. The attorney entirely fails to challenge the government's case. In Bell versus Cohn, the Supreme Court said, when we said entirely, we meant entirely. I think if you extend that, if you extrapolate that and look for a reasonable application, what you come to the conclusion is that under Category 1, which is what we're in, the deprivation of counsel category that Mr. Van Patten wants to invoke, the criterion in the U.S. Supreme Court was complete denial of counsel. This is not complete denial of counsel. I'm not disputing that he wasn't there physically, but he had the assistance of counsel, if only partially. The standard under Cronic is complete denial. So that kicks us back between Bell versus Cohn and Hill versus Lockhart into Strickland. And Strickland, under the prejudice standard, says, asked whether he would have pleaded guilty anyway. The circuit court in Wisconsin said, you would have pleaded guilty anyway. The court made a credibility judgment on Mr. Van Patten's assertions and said, I don't believe you. That's why I think that regardless of whether that you can't apply Cronic, and why when you apply Strickland, you don't get to the prejudice test. Yeah, you don't satisfy the prejudice standard. That I think is what simplifies this down to where how to resolve whether Strickland or Cronic applies. And I think it's clear that Strickland applies. And once you apply Strickland, it doesn't satisfy the prejudice standard that Mr. Van Patten had to meet. The court has
so can you just speak to Van Patten's inability to communicate non-verbally with his attorney? I mean, that's one of the points that counsel's making, that it's not just what's said.
I understand
but it's, that. You know, counsel's observation of the client being able to communicate non-verbally.
Mm-hmm. Well, it raises kind of a. I'll deal with this by analogy. The implication of the requirement, and I don't want to make too much of this, but the implication of the requirement is that an attorney that lacks sight, who's present, would be providing ineffective assistance because that blind attorney could not detect those physical tremors or whatever it is, those subtle cues that arise physically. I think that's one of the reasons that while it's important that the attorney be able to consult with the client, that it doesn't necessarily require in this context, because it's ultimately the judge's decision to read and make the determination whether it's been the plea is being entered
but
voluntarily.
But then there's kind of a fallacy with that analogy because, of course, the client would know his counsel was blind.
That's true.
You know,
that's
and
true.
So with knowing that counsel's blind, yeah. You know you have to communicate verbally.
I understand that.
Counsel can't observe.
Counsel,
so
what was the date of the plea hearing?
The plea hearing here was, as I recall, it was September 12, 1995.
All right. When was the sentencing?
Sentencing was about 2 months later. I think it was November 9th.
Did the defendant at any time during that two-month period ask to confer with counsel?
He's claiming in this proceeding that he did in
I'm
the state.
I'm asking you from the court record.
From the court record at the state level, no. There's no indication that he did any of that. He didn't present any evidence before the sentencing on that.
Did he have any communication with the court or his prior attorney that he asked him to challenge the sentence in any manner?
There's nothing in the state court record that suggests that he had any complaint about the plea until he heard what his sentence was.
And this all began sometime after it when other counsel was appointed?
This all began apparently as soon as he heard the sentence. I don't know whether he had a counsel
appointed. That was after the two-month period?
That was after the two-month period.
How long after the two-month period?
Well, apparently in this case, he submitted a letter dated November 11th that indicated some dissatisfaction with the plea.
After the sentencing?
That would have been a couple of days after the sentencing, I believe. And then there were some other letters. I frankly have not seen these because they were submitted to the court by Mr. Van Patten, and I was never copied on them. But I understand from the brief filed by Ms. Coberly that there were other letters that were submitted that Judge Randall looked at that were in the record, and he concluded that none of them raised a claim that he was concerned before sentencing about the plea arrangements.
Before you sit down, this was a fairly, I think, favorable plea to enter, assuming there was a factual basis for it. But the original charge was an intentional
first-degree intentional homicide, yes,
with a penalty of.
I forget what that's under the old sentencing law. I've forgotten exactly. It could have been, I think, up to life.
It was life.
Yeah, with
could have been
with
life.
With the opportunity for parole.
Yeah, but it could have been life, and the judge sets parole, and could have been set in such a way that you never see the light of day.
Right. Right.
And this was a reduction in the reckless from intentional, which. If your option is go to trial and take a chance or plead out, that's not unreasonable to plead out.
That's
then
what
then doesn't it go back to the original charge, too? The state can withdraw it?
That's correct. And
oh, yeah. That's clear here that if we let him back out of the plea, then he'd face the intentional homicide.
And Judge Schmidt, that's what Judge Schmidt concluded after the post-conviction motion hearing, that in fact that was Mr. Van Patten's motivation. He wanted the reduced, he wanted the assurance of a reduced sentence, and that's why he pleaded. It had nothing to do with any sort of coercion by his attorney not being physically present in court.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll give you 1 minute.
Thank you. I'd like to make a couple quick points. First of all, under Williams versus Taylor and under AEDPA, a case can be contrary to Supreme Court precedent if the state court arrives at the opposite conclusion from the Supreme Court on a question of law. If the court applies the wrong rule this court need not defer to it. There's no reason to believe that the court has to find its the state court's conclusion to be unreasonable, objectively unreasonable, in order to award relief here. Secondly, there is no rule that Strickland applies in guilty pleas. In fact, in Kronick itself, the court cited its decision in Hamilton versus Alabama as an example of a situation in which prejudice would be presumed if the defendant was denied counsel at an arraignment. So Kronick, by its own terms, applies to arraignments and plea hearings. Bell versus Cohn, which counsel mentioned in his argument, concerned a case where the defendant was essentially arguing that his counsel had been ineffective at sentencing. And the court concluded that ineffectiveness claims, such as that one, should be decided under Strickland.
Okay.
That's all that case stands for.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The case will be taken under advisement, and once again, you have the thanks of all the judges on the panel for accepting appointment and
thank you.
Vigorously
very well done.
Representing your client. Court is in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:30.